any other shelter or obliged to seek shelter at the lotus feet of the Supreme Friend, if from the very beginning we seek shelter of the Supreme Friend, there will be no cause of danger. It is said that if a dog is swimming in the water and one wants to cross the ocean by catching hold of the dog's tail, certainly he is foolish. Similarly, if in distress one seeks shelter of a demigod, he is foolish, for his efforts will be fruitless. In all circumstances, one should seek shelter of the Supreme Personality of Godhead. Then there will be no danger under any circumstances. Srila Prabhupada ki jai. Krishna says in the Bhagavad Gita, Chatur vidha bhajante mam janasu kriti narjuna. Atartho jnani, what is that? Atartho jignasu atarthi jnani cha bharatarshaba. So he says there are four types of pious persons that take shelter of me. Jana Sukritina. Sukritina means those who have a background of piety. Then there are four types: those who are materially distressed, those who are inquisitive, those who are after material remuneration, and those who are having some knowledge of spiritual matters, the Absolute. So these are the four types of persons who will approach the Supreme Personality of Godhead. Sri Baladeva Vibhushana comments that the reason jignasu, so the first one is the distressed person, then the inquisitive person is in the middle, and then the person after material remuneration comes next. So Sri Baladeva Vibhushana in his commentary comments that the reason jignasu comes in the middle is because both the materially distressed and those after material remuneration, they should both become inquisitive about the Absolute Truth, or else their taking shelter of the Supreme Lord will be insubstantial, because after their distress situation is removed or their material desires are satisfied, then again they go back to material plane for trying to exploit the material nature, trying to enjoy. So he comments that that's the reason why jignasu is mentioned in the middle. One should actually become inquisitive about understanding the Absolute Truth. Otherwise, his surrender will be insubstantial. So we see here the demigods, they're mixed devotees. And so throughout the Bhagavatam, you will see them taking shelter of the Personality of God. And every time things get rough, most of the time they're enjoying, because that's what it means to be a demigod. This is why demigod life is not considered as auspicious as human birth, because the enjoyment is very intense. So it's very hard to appreciate the necessity of taking shelter of the Personality of Godhead. So the demigods are, most of the time, they're enjoying. But when they get into a very heavy situation, they always take shelter of the Personality of Godhead. This is how you know they're devotees. They don't take shelter of others. They take shelter only of the Supreme Lord. and as such, they receive some relief from their difficulties. So Prabhupada is even indicating in verse that the demigods actually offer in the sixth canto that they know that if you take shelter of others, that's like catching hold of the tail of a dog and trying to cross the ocean. Just like a dog cannot cross an ocean, so a man holding onto the tail of a dog cannot cross the ocean. The dog will throw him off and he himself will also drown. Yes, if you grab hold of the tail of a dog, then the dog, what you doing, man, get off me. And then the dog himself will also drown. This is given in the commentary like this. The dog will throw him off, get off me, you know, get off me. And the dog himself, he will also drown. So the tail of the dog, or the dog, is compared to various processes of yoga or the various devatas which one may take shelter of for relief from material misery. Just like Krishna says, Kamai Shashtar Hitigana, Prapadyante Anya Devataha, Tam Tamniya Mamastaya, Pakritaniya Taswaya. Those whose intelligence has been stolen by lusty desires, then they take shelter of other devas. And the type of deva they take shelter of is usually one that corresponds with the material nature in which they're influenced by. So then one whose intelligence is disturbed in this way, they take shelter of devatas, they take shelter of gyan, They take shelter of karma and yoga because they're bewildered. And those processes will throw them off, and those processes will also cease to be useful. And the ultimate issue, because they cannot help one to transcend the material nature, which is really the only way you can be free ultimately from material distress. So the demigods know, those who take shelter of others, devas, gyan, yoga, karma, then those processes will throw them off, leaving them fruitless, and those processes themselves will also be unsuccessful. Therefore, Supreme Lord, we're taking shelter of you, because we know you are the Sarvaloka Maheshwaram, Suridam Sarvabhutanam, Prabhupada's quoting this verse in the purport. Sarvaloka Maheshwaram means he's the controller of the material nature, the whole cosmos. And Suridam Sarvabhutanam, he's the well-wishing friend of everyone. Now, Gantwa Mam Shantam Richati, the person who knows this, Gantwa, he is having cognition of this, then Shantam Richati, he can be peaceful. Only that person can be peaceful. But see, we see here the demigods are not peaceful. They know the Supreme Lord is Sarvaloka Maheshwaram, Suridam Sarvabhutanam, but they're not peaceful. Krishna says anyone who knows this, they will be peaceful. But the demigods are not peaceful. Why are they not peaceful? Because their surrender to that point is not substantial. They're wanting to surrender to God so that he can make their material situation nice. This is the general tendency of even the religious minded. Like I often tell this story when I was on the train station going for book distribution. Revati Nalanda Prabhu, the devotee train, we would keep a cart with Lord Jagannath pictures all over the cart everywhere. And when we were transitioning from the red line to the blue line, I had to do it. I was forced. He was seeing Jai Jagannath like super loud in the hallway, you know, so everyone can see. And then everyone would look at the car. He said, "That's Jagannath." And then he was saying, it was really intense. And we got off we got up to the blue line, and one Christian was there dressed in a very nice suit. And he was like, "Who's that?" And Revati Nalanda Prabhu was like, "That's Jagannath." And the guy was like, "Who's Jagannath?" He's like, "That's the Supreme Personality of Godhead." And then Krishna went, like this. And he was like, "What has your God done for you?" You know, then Revati Nalanda Prabhu started walking off. He was like, "I'm not going to deal with this riffraff." So he said, "What has your God done for you?" "My God gave me a nice house, a good wife, a good car, a good job, making money." He went like through a whole list of all the things he was getting. And then he said, "What has your God done for you?" So I just threw a kaisa. He took all those things away. That way I can focus on him and not all these other things. So the person who is having insubstantial understanding of Krishna as being the controller of the cosmos and the well-wishing friend, then they protest the arrangements that the Supreme Lord is making for them, which may include having Hiranyakashipu as the government, you know, the leader of the government and subjugating the whole universe. You'll never see Prahlad Maharaj praying like the demigods. "Oh, Krishna, why are you putting me in this situation?" and so on. Because he will be knowing, you are Sarvaloka Maheshwaram, you are Suridam Sarvabhutanam, therefore, there is nothing to complain. So, therefore, in the culture of pure devotion, we are trained up in this particular verse, Tate Nukampam Sukshamikshamano Bunjana Evatma Kritam Vipakam Hrivagva Pubevadadanamaste Jiveta Yomukti Pade Sadayabhak. We're trained up in this mentality, that being very eagerly awaiting the mercy of the Lord, and the mercy of the Lord is not the removal of demoniac governments, please. That's not exactly the mercy of the Lord that the devotee is aspiring after. He's aspiring after getting the goal of his life. The goal of a sadhana, a sadhaka, is bhav bhakti. And he's waiting for that mercy. That's real mercy, to get love for Krishna. So waiting for that mercy of the Lord to descend. In the meantime, Bunjana evatma kritam vipakam. He's tolerating the distressful situations which are the result of his own karma. At least he thinks in this way. Either it's the result of his own karma, and in his humility he'll think like this, or it's the Supreme Lord making that arrangement to crush the scent or to remove the scent of materialism that may still be in his personality. So he just tolerates that on there. Bunjana actually means one who's enjoying or eating. So the idea here is in that word is that you got to eat what you cook. And this is the expression that's given. You got to eat what you cook. Just like when I was in Vrindavan, I was cooking for myself for the first time after a really long time. And so the first time I made the khichdi, it was interesting. It was edible, so that was good. But it didn't really taste right and so on. But I cooked and it was a whole bunch, so I had to eat that. I guess I could have just went outside and threw it to the monkeys, you know. But the idea is you got to eat what you cook. So I've cooked up something by my previous activities, and now they're manifesting my present life, and I got to eat that. That's the idea. I got to eat that. So the devotee tolerates that, and he doesn't protest. Sri Bhagava Pubevadadam Namaste. Rather, he continues to offer his heart, body, and words in the services of the Supreme Lord. And in this way, Jiveta Yo Mukti Padesa Dayabhag, for that jiva, liberation becomes his inheritance. He inherits liberation like this. So this is a substantial surrender. Otherwise, like the Devatas, there is some troubled situation. Then we approach the Supreme Lord. Then the troubled situation goes away. Then we go away for some time until another troubled situation comes up. So Prabhupada is saying, in a condition of distress or misery, one wants to seek shelter of a well-wishing friend. And that's Krishna. He's the perfect well-wishing friend. So therefore, all the inhabitants go to him. But then Prabhupada says, if from the very beginning we seek shelter of the Supreme Friend, there will be no cause of danger. If from the very beginning, in the very beginning one learns how to surrender, actually that state of being surrendered to Krishna is itself a state of fearlessness. Well, to speak of God actually doing something in reciprocation with your surrender, the state or the consciousness of surrender is itself a state of shelter. What to speak of actually receiving God's appearance before you, and he grabs you up and embraces you, and, oh, okay, now I feel really sheltered. The state of that consciousness is itself a state of shelter. Therefore, you don't find Prahlad Maharaj showing any fear of his father, or as the demigods were demonstrating, because that consciousness is itself a state of shelter from the irritation of mundane consciousness. What is that? From the irritation of mundane consciousness. There's like a nice bhajan of Bhaktivinoda Thakur in Sharanagati where he prays in this way, since I have taken shelter of you, everywhere I look, I see happiness. Since I've taken shelter of you. So therefore, from the very beginning, we take shelter of the personality of Godhead. Then our surrender shall progress nicely. And being in a state of surrender consciousness, then there will be no question of anxiety and one is peaceful. Rather, notwithstanding the types of situations created around us in the environment. So we see that in the vision of Bhaktivinoda Thakur, the state of being fully surrendered is a state that actually manifests at the stage of Ruchi Bhakti. Of course, it begins from the very beginning, Adhau Shraddha. But because of anarthas and so on, it tends to not always be that substantial. We have doubts, we have confusion about various things. So then one has to come to the state of Nishtha, which is a state of realization of the self different from matter. And then Ruchi Bhakti is a state of absorption in Krishna consciousness. It's the beginning of Shuddha Bhakti, according to Bhaktivinoda Thakur. And it's also the state in which surrendered consciousness is fully, let's say, evinced or manifest. He speaks about this in Bhakti Tattva Vivek. So therefore, that state of consciousness is already free from material affinity. Therefore, there could be no question of being bewildered by duality, as in the case of the demigods here. So Prabhupada saying from the very beginning we developed that, then there would be no cause of danger. Even though Hiranyakashipu is in your face, even though he's in your grill, there would be no cause of danger. Hare Krishna. Any questions, comments? Otherwise, I'll move on a little bit. It's only 7:45. Yeah. Acharya Nishtha Prabhupada.
So the devotee is developing this vision that everything that's happening, everything that exists is the mercy of the Lord, it's Krishna's will. So if you could just comment how in materialistic society, there's even in our subconscious, there's this overarching fear that things are going on without a director, that there's accidents happening, there's mistakes happening, there's some deathly illness, something happens to a devotee, or this shouldn't have happened. There's this underlying fear of a lack of that Krishna's in control, especially in the materialistic society. They think, oh, God's not there, so we have to take care of people. We have to feed them. God stepped away. So then how can we maybe English comment on more deeply, seeing how all the circumstances in our lives, even the devotee's life, is seemingly difficult, you know, that we can have faith that Krishna is personally, or Krishna is maintaining that situation.
Yeah, seeing like that means one has to purify his subtle body. Because we see according to the, our vision of the world is according to the purification or lack thereof in the subtle body. You know, if you have red colored glasses on, you see the world red. If you got blue colored glasses, you see the world blue. So like this, one has to purify the subtle body. Otherwise, his seeing will be accordingly. So in the anamaya state of consciousness, means what? You know, self-centered selfishness, sense gratification. You know, ana literally means eating. So that means the concern is just about eating. You know, you eat with the tongue, various tastes. You eat with the ears, various sounds. You eat with the eyes, various forms. You eat with the nose, various smells. You eat with the skin, various, touches? Touches. The various objects you want to feel. So this is eating. So it's the platform of self-centered sense enjoyment. And so in that way, there's a heavy struggle for existence on the material platform. When people elevate their consciousness, they come in the pranamaya consciousness, which means self-extended selfishness. And on that platform of consciousness, things such as political issues, social issues, economic issues, all these sorts of issues become very important. And in that state of consciousness, there's really no awareness of an afterlife, of a spiritual substratum for existence. So then, for them, for such persons on such a platform of consciousness, these become the important things. But it's just an extension of their false ego. It has nothing to do with spiritual life. And so it seems very commendable, like when you see people fighting for various social issues, such as, you know, let's say marriage equality is a popular one these days, racial equality is a popular one these days. Not so much, but environmental rights, animal rights, these, and they seem very noble. And from a relative platform, arguably they are very noble, but actually, ultimately, they're totally useless. And it just end up one fight after another without any conclusion. Well, conclusion is death, and then you take on another material body. So on that platform, because of lack of purification on the subtle body, they're thinking these things to be very important. So then the Gyanamaya platform is a platform of religious culture, basically. And that's the platform where sadhana also begins. So with religious culture and obviously with sadhana, there's purification of the subtle body. So then they start to see the world in a wholly different way. Even those who are on the platform of religious life for sense gratification, they see that there's a background to the material existence. The devatas are there. We can't see them, but they're there, and we have to offer oblations to them in order for there to be prosperity on the material platform. So they begin to see, of course, by the shastra conjunctions, and they have faith in that. So they begin to see in that way. There's a background to all of this. Of course, they only care about that background in terms of their enjoyment, but at least they come to appreciate there is a background to the existence. As they make a little advancement through their religious culture, they get a little bit purified in their subtle body, they start to appreciate that there is more to life than trying to enjoy the material platform. There's actually a spiritual substratum in life, and this world is temporary, it's ephemeral. And therefore, they start trying to realize the soul. And then they take up some process of sadhana, usually nishkama karma yoga traditionally, and then at least again in ashtanga yoga. And then they become totally detached from these affairs. So even though things are heavy, like they have a Hiranyakashipu like a government, they become callous to it. And then for the bhaktas, when this is the highest state, they come to, that's Vijnana Maya platform, by the way, when they become callous to everything happening on the material platform. It is of no particular interest to them. And then the devotees, Ananda is called Krishna's mercy. You know, and that's more than just a purified subtle body, it's the influence of bhakti to Krishna, which is a completely spiritual element. So in this way, we see according to the purification of our subtle body. So even for devotees, you know, we also get stuck on the pranamaya level of consciousness. It's not like these levels of consciousness are mutually exclusive. They shift around. Just like now, we might be in the Gyanamaya platform of consciousness right now, doing the religious thing. Okay, I got to go to the temple program, you know. This kind of Gyanamaya, we're doing some sadhana to purify ourselves. But then when prasadam comes, then we, you know, the how you say, the like skydiving, and the consciousness just drops to the Anamaya platform of consciousness, just like yesterday, the birthday party, or 2 days ago, and the cake came out, and this came out, and that came out, and the consciousness drops. So they're not like mutually exclusive. Unless there's sufficient purification of the subtle body, you are trapped on that platform. And then you have all sorts of arguments about why these things are important, and no one will be able to convince you that it's not really that important. And of course, even devotees, we may know this is not important in the grand scheme of things, but we have to live, and we have to know how to establish our communities. These things are not unimportant also. And that way you just get stuck. So it depends on how much purification of self is going on. There's no question, just like the other day, the question came up that we should be forgiving. But there's no question of forgiving. You have to be purified. You can try. I mean, and you should try. But if you're not sufficiently purified in your soul or body, no question of forgiving. It'll just be a show for impressing the outside world. Look how forgiving. But in your heart, you'll be pinched like anything because you're not purified enough. So, you know, that's the nice thing about spiritual life, is that it can't be faked. As they say, excuse my Sanskrit, but all the chit hits the fan sooner or later, according to your consciousness. Chit. Chit means knowledge. Chit is the Shakti that reveals everything. Huh? It's called the Chit Shakti. It's also referred to as the Swarup Shakti or the Antaranga Shakti, but it's also called as the Chit Shakti. So the chit hits the fan sooner or later. In other words, things become revealed sooner or later. You can't get out of that. So one has to, spiritual life, go up. Himanshu Guru.
Thank you for this class, especially because this topic is really in my mind. I've been reading a lot of different things about this idea of surrender. And one thing I'm realizing this morning after hearing your discussion is perhaps in my own self, I'm thinking about two examples from the Srimad Bhagavatam, the classic example of the young girls of Braj performing the Katyayani Vrata and then coming to take bath in the river Yamuna, and then Krishna stealing their clothes, which is often glorified as an example of full abandonment, full sort of surrender towards the Lord. And also the wives of the Yakya Patnis coming to, leaving their husbands. They're also sort of glorified as an example of such great surrender. They didn't care about the social backlash or anything like that. They just came to Krishna and Balaram because they were hungry. And one thing I'm realizing after your discussion this morning is perhaps in my own life, when I'm struggling to sort of have the view that, don't worry about your spiritual maintenance, your physical maintenance, Krishna will take care, that perhaps I'm trying to put the cart before the horse. Because when you look at the classic examples, what precipitates their surrender is this intense attraction for Krishna. So because that intense attraction is there, that surrender is sort of just like a side effect. You know what I'm saying? There's no thought. And it's not even like a consideration. They just, because of that attraction, they just do it, And I'm wondering if in our own life, sometimes we maybe encourage others also, like, you should surrender, or ourselves also, maybe we want to surrender more. But would you say that the sort of stage for that is this attraction towards Krishna? And if that's not there, then you may take a step of surrender, but it may not be as substantial. I don't know. Or does the surrender lead to that attraction? I'm just trying to understand.
I kind of commented on that. I said, according to the vision of Bhaktivinoda Thakur, the state of Ruchi Bhakti is the state of full surrender. Ruchi means intense attraction for Krishna also, and manifest it as this absorption in bhajan. And from that attraction, deep, deep, deep surrender is coming. Anyway, even if using your logic, we have to be deeply attracted before we can be deeply surrendered. So then how do you get deeply attracted? Then you have to hear and do Nam Sankirtan, and a lot of it, the more the better. Just like the Yajna Patnis, how they get that deep attraction for Krishna? They were hearing from the flower girls. Apparently in Vedic culture, you would have girls who would come around house to house and they would give flowers. And these flower girls, they were always singing Krishna's glories. So whenever they would come to distribute the flowers, the Yajna Patnis were hearing about Krishna's glories. They never saw him, but they were hearing about Krishna's glories. And from that hearing, they developed this deep attraction to Krishna. So using your logic, there should be deep attraction before there could be deep surrender. Then how to get it? Then you got to hear about Krishna. And that includes topics that culminate in the glories of Krishna. I was just reading that in the second canto. So you hear about the creation and this and that. Those topics culminate in the glories of the Lord. So those topics are not to be eschewed, but also heard. Then like this, it comes up. So like our process is not like the yogis trying to just grit the teeth and, you know, meditate on the faults of the material nature and contemplate our anartas. Oh, that anartha is coming. I should really go deep into that and try to figure it out, you know. The Bhagavatam already covered that. You have an ocean of anarthas. So there's no question of contemplating it, you know. Otherwise, you'll be stuck on that only. Thinking about this anartha, where is this? Where is that one coming up from? And, you know, getting psychoanalyzed, you know, you come in, sit in the chair and lay back, and one devotee is there. So what is this? And you're like, well, it all started in my childhood, you know. And which childhood? This life or 10 lifetimes ago? You know, we already messed up from so many lifetimes. You know, that's not the process. The process is to augment Shravanam and Kirtanam as much as possible. You know, if you're a little bit crazy, like clinically, take some medicine, you know, so you can be a little chilled out. And then do a lot of Shravanam and Kirtanam after that. You know, if you happen to be a little bit messed up, you know, you had a rough childhood or whatever, and you're kind of clinically jacked up, you know, that can happen. You know, and those impressions are really bewildering you. Take a little some medicine so you get a little sedated, a little subdued, and then do a lot of Shravanam and Kirtanam. We don't do so much, to be honest with you. We relegate the hearing and chanting to the Bhagavatam class and the morning program, and that's all the Shravanam, that's all our life's energy dedicated to the process of Krishna consciousness. You know, because everything else becomes also the process of Krishna consciousness, so the actual process isn't good enough to warrant our actual attention to it. And then we wonder why we're not making any spiritual advancement, you know, or all of our spiritual advancement just becomes like a mental speculation. I feel that I'm improved, I feel that I'm better. Well, what is the evidence? The evidence is your attraction to Shravanam and Kirtanam. Dharma sunushita pumsam vikshraksena katasuyaha na upadaya yadirachim shama evi kevalam. Bhagavatam clearly says whatever dharma you're doing, if it is not invoking attraction to Shravanam and Kirtanam, then it is so much useless labor. And that includes the various angas of bhakti aside from Shravanam and Kirtanam. You know, you're getting attached to doing this thing and that thing and this thing, but it is not seen that your attraction to hearing and chanting is evolving. Then you have to question how you applying the process. Something might be wrong. This is the most important thing. There was another point that I was going to make in this regard. So like this, one has to increase the Shravan and Kirtanam process. Then the attraction to Krishna will come up. And then this deep surrender can follow. That was your logic. So then how to get the attraction? There has to be more of the real thing. Like that. Yeah. I had another comment I wanted to say, but I forgot. It left me.
So when we hear about the nine processes of the, when you mention that Shravanam and Kirtanam are the, like, the main points to...
And Smarnam.
Yeah, and Smarnam. To understand how advanced we are. Is this saying basically that the other processes are auxiliary and it's complementing these? Or is it saying that these first three are actually the highest, even though they seem...
Well, in the presentation I showed yesterday, it was clearly told. There was no ambiguity there. Shravanam, Kirtanam, Smarnam were considered the kings. And out of them, and Sankirtan, of the names of Krishna dear to one, is the emperor. So you can say, in one sense, all the angas of bhakti are auxiliary to Nam Sankirtan, you know, which means that Nam Sankirtan should be going on prominently, and the other things are auxiliary to help us do that. Like this. It was clearly told like that. There was no ambiguity there. So to be a Hare Krishna means primarily you're chanting Hare Krishna, like, and a lot of it. Japa and Sankirtan. And the other processes are exactly, you'll see, you'll need help of the other angas, particularly Shravanam. You need a lot of help from that, because we don't have the proper mind language, psychological orientation towards Krishna. So that can be corrected by the Shravanam process. Similarly, Padasevanam, doing various services, and like in the temple, deity worship and all these things. These will help to purify one's physical situation also. And so they're helpful, but helpful for what point? So then this point, the main point, like that. Yeah. I'd like to try and prove, to enjoy prove.
Just a small question for you. So I was thinking about Prahlad Maharaj, when he prays to the Singh Dev later on that, I'm not afraid of material energy, but I'm worried about all the other people who are in the material time and so on. Mm-hmm. I was thinking, aren't they also doing their activities under the control of the Supreme God? So there, the devotee does feel some concern.
Yeah, the concern that they're not Krishna conscious. The question is that Prahlad Maharaj prays that for myself, I'm not in any anxiety caused by this samsara existence, but my heart is going out to all these fools and rascals who are Maya Sukhaya. They're holding the burden of the happiness of Maya, and they're turned away from you. My concern is going out to them. But he's saying, but aren't they? This is also part of the arrangement of the Supreme Lord. So then why he's concerned as such, like this? As, you know, that's also part of the arrangement of the Supreme Lord. So, you know, like that. That might be like, you know, a sadhaka could be in that mood. Arguably, it's going on. I myself got to get out, you know. So I think that's a healthy sort of, at least some element of that is healthy for sadhakas, because we're not Krishna conscious. But Prahlad Maharaj is actually Krishna conscious. So he has that contrasting experience, well, to some degree, of seeing the not Krishna conscious state and being actually Krishna conscious. So he's feeling for people who are not Krishna conscious. He's not lamenting the plight of their material existence. Krishna already covers that in the Bhagavad Gita, that the self-realized person, what to speak of the bhakta, just the jnani, he does not lament for the living or for the dying. So that would not be of particular concern for Prahlad Maharaj. He's lamenting that they're not Krishna conscious like that, and therefore his heart is going out to them. You know, out of mercy. Why are they not Krishna conscious? So you can say, well, the Lord doesn't want them to be Krishna conscious. Then we hear, therefore, the devotees are more merciful than the Supreme Lord. So the Supreme Lord, he will wait for you to approach him. And there's a good chance you might not do that for millions of lives because you're bewildered. But the devotee is more merciful than Krishna. So he will reach out and try to make someone actually Krishna conscious. By what? Shravanam, Kirtanam, Smaranam, Vishnu. That's how people become Krishna conscious. We have so many preaching programs now, you know, the prasadam distribution, which is nice. These are good. That can help also. They're eating Krishna prasadam, no doubt. That's important. Or we have you have the yoga bridge program, the kirtan, that's a little bit better, bridge program, you know. But nowadays, even devotees are chanting mantras to Hanuman and Ganesh to satisfy the senses of their audiences. And then you have the psychology bridge program, preaching psychology and all these things. But that's not going to make people Krishna conscious. They're going to make them crazy. All that psychoanalysis going on, they're going to get nuts, you know. And they're thinking, ooh, I'm making advancements spiritually. And all mental speculation. The devotee's kirtan is mostly of Vishnu, like that. And that is his compassion towards the conditioned animation. Just like Bhaktivinoda Thakur says that the duty of a Madhyamadhikari, he said, aside from the practical affairs which should be tended to, people are, you know, attached on a material platform, so you should tend to some. He said, but the primary duty of a Madhyamadhikari is to make the person, to help him to gain taste for the chanting of the holy names of Krishna. That's his primary duty. As a Madhyamadhikari, as a preacher, is to help him get taste for chanting the holy name. Which means that the preacher himself has to have some namruchi. Otherwise, there can be no question of jivadaya in the real sense. Jivadaya can only be there if there's namruchi, because you gotta help people to get taste for chanting the holy name of Krishna. Anyway, that's the philosophy of Krishna consciousness. It's a little impractical. It comes in the Jiva Dharma. I believe it comes in chapter 6 of the Jiva Dharma. He speaks about that. No, not chapter 6. I forget chapter 8 maybe or 9. I forget which chapter. I'll have to look it up. It's a little impractical. That's what spiritual life is in some ways. Don't misunderstand me. I'm being a little playful here. But in other words, it's a little lofty. And usually we want practical, like super practical. Therefore, the tendency to want to sit in the chair and be psychoanalyzed, because that seems practical, instead of just taking shelter of the holy name of Krishna, which seems a little impractical. Like this. Yeah, joy.
Hare Krishna. You mentioned someone who's in distress taking shelter in the Lord, and even the state of consciousness itself being a form of shelter.
Yeah.
So, one, you know, naturally, one can become easily attached to the shelter, right? You know, is it possible that the shelter, I guess, you know, so chanting the mantra, you know, singing kirtan, is it possible that it could lead to maybe a fear of being outside the state of consciousness, in a sense, a hiding?
Yeah, that's good.
The stress of the material world.
That's good.
And if so, is this counterproductive to spiritual progress?
No, not at all. Okay, so my way of see if I understand it properly. So we may get attached to the shelter. That's good. So check, good. Being attached to the shelter of Krishna is a good thing. Because usually we're attached to other sorts of low-level shelters which are leading us to samsara. Could that create a state of fear of being outside the shelter? Yes, that's also good, check. Just like fear, it's not that, just like there's fear in the spiritual world too. Just like, for example, when Krishna's, there's one type of love, expression of love or love of Krishna called prema vaichitya. Prema vaichitya means that you're with Krishna, but you're always afraid he's about to bounce at any moment. So you, even though you're with Krishna, he's right before you and you're having an exchange, you're feeling nervous because your heart is always feeling anxiety because you think Krishna at any moment might bounce and I won't be able to see him anymore. This prema vaichitya is particularly prominent in Dwarka, where they know Krishna is always meditating on Braja, so he might just bounce at any moment and leave us high and dry. And so it's a type of ecstatic symptom. So there's fear there. That's a little high. A little high, you know, bring it back down. Here's Bob, and then, okay, down in a sudden level. And you know, then Nishtha, okay, down in the beginning of Bhajana Kriya. So now we're back down to Earth planet. That having that fear of being outside the shelter will protect us. It'll be a protective shield from chasing after the shelters of the material world, which are apparent to us, very apparent. I'll have shelter and money. I'll have shelter and a spouse. I'll have shelter and a nice house. This is very natural for conditioned souls to think in this way. This is where I'll be secure. Shelter means a place where I find security. So we're not finding that security in the Supreme Lord. You got to find it somewhere, because the conditioned soul cannot exist without a shelter. Actually, his eternal constitutional position is sheltered in God. Krishna says that clearly in Bhagavad Gita, Mamayavam Shojiva Loke. That the conscious jiva is a conscious part of me. So he's already sheltered in the Paramatma eternally. And there's no change of that situation. So his natural psychology is to seek shelter also. So if he's not seeking shelter of the Lord, and he's not afraid of being outside that shelter, then that means there's the default shelters are there. And then you go after those things. So it's not counterproductive. But like we were saying, that if one is really sheltered in the Lord, then you'll also be satisfied with the various circumstances that are coming up in your life. So how can that be counterproductive? You're in a state of satisfaction and just focusing on the Supreme Lord and his worship. Seeing that something is happening, just like you'll see devotees get sick, like severely sick, and they take medicines and all these things to try to correct their situation as far as they're able to, but then nothing is working. They're not complaining about it. They're just chanting Hare Krishna and worshiping the Lord and so on. So that is a state of shelter consciousness. And for us, for them, there's no question of being afraid of leaving that, because there's no question of leaving. For us, there is a question of probably leaving. And therefore, it comes up in our, well, that might not be a good idea. And that's a good way to think like that. Otherwise, you're chasing after Maya, shelter in Maya. The conditioned soul has to have some shelter. It's impossible to live without. So you're sheltered in the material nature or Krishna. And then be afraid, just like people are afraid to leave the shelter of Maya and come to Krishna. Now, that's bad. Just like, well, if I join the ashram, what will happen to my relationship with my girlfriend? You know, and that would be like a very serious concern for them. You know, what if my parents, they're not favorable, what if they reject me? Like that, and these sorts of things. And then they don't want to come to Krishna because they're feeling shelter in these things. And so that's bad. But then you come to Krishna, well, what if I leave Krishna? What if I go to my parents and I'm not able to make it back to Krishna because they trap me with all these responsibilities? Then better I stay here. That is good. Of course, that's a little bit of a brahmachari flair to it, but that is actually good. If I go to my parents, they may trap me and get me married, and then I have all these duties and I can't get back to Krishna. So therefore, I better stay here. That is good. Good thinking. And Krishna will very much appreciate that. In fact, when you hear the sadhu described in the shastras, many places, just one place is Kapila Dev describing the sadhus who are very dear to Krishna. In all the descriptions, it is given how they give up all these material shelters, house, wife, children, society. It's inevitably always a description like that describing the sadhu's consciousness. He just gives it up. If they're not devotees and not favorable to Krishna, just because I can't leave the shelter of Krishna. So that is a good thing, definitely. That's my, yeah.
Thank you for your great answer to the question. I guess to expand on it, you know, so you're inside the shelter, one is inside the shelter, Krishna, and afraid to look over the walls and see what's on the other side, maybe like personal hang-ups or like things even within the mind you're taking shelter from or avoiding confrontation with by recitation of the mantra.
Like an escapism sort of thing.
Yes, exactly. And is that also healthy? Or can
that... You know, and you might hear different angles of vision of this. I always say in the beginning it is a little healthy, because of the built-in default predilection towards those things. So a little bit of that in the beginning stage is healthy, although it can be counterproductive, because ultimately you will... the nature of having Krishna as our chariot driver, if you will, Krishna's the chariot driver of our life once we become a devotee. And the nature of having Krishna as our chariot driver is that he'll put the chariot in front of all the heavy things that we're really attached to. You won't be able to actually escape it. Just like Arjuna. Arjuna said, please pull my chariot in the center of the battlefield so I can see with whom I have to contend in this trial of arms. And Krishna was like, okay, cool, no problem. And he pulled the chariot right in front of Bhishma and Drona, which was Arjuna's greatest attachments. And he said, look, there's the core of our army. And then Arjuna was like, he started freaking out. And then Krishna was like, yeah, you got to kill them. Yeah, that's important. You got to kill them. So like that, the nature of having Krishna as our chariot driver is that you will not ultimately be able to escape. The nature of spiritual life, I would say in general, and particularly of bhakti, is that it's going to make you 100% authentic. 100% authentic. So if there's anything hiding in the closet, it's going to come out sooner or later. And you will be face to face with that. And you will have to kill it or be killed, so to speak, at least in this life. So maybe a little bit of that consciousness in the beginning, like you'll find this in the SSR, where one lady is writing Srila Prabhupada about the devotees being so negative about the material world, you know, criticizing it excessively, and she's saying, you know, you have to handpick these pieces of sunshine, and she's using all this really funny language, you know, and understand that love is, and you should just allow love to be. You know, they're too negative like this. This is her language in the letter. So Prabhupada responds to the letter. And in the beginning of the letter, he apologizes. He said, these boys are new. They're neophyte. And therefore, there may be some excessive indulgence in these things because they want to protect themselves from victimization by Maya. So they may kind of go over the top a little bit. And he says, so he apologizes for that. And then for the rest of the letter, the vast majority of the letter, He says, but you should know that this world is negative. And then the rest of the letters is about all the bad things in the material world. And then he says, you've spoken of love, but you should know that there is no love in this material world. And he's heavy. And then at the end of the letter, he says, despite their immaturity, they have surrendered to Krishna, and that is never a mistake. So, and the nature of being in the process of Krishna consciousness, it's going to make you 100% authentic. So therefore, expect to come in contact with the things you're trying to escape. Expect it to come up, those heavy things to come before you, you know, sooner or later. For some people, depending on their intensity of practice, it comes up sooner. For others, it comes up later. But it comes up. There's no question of escaping. Because Krishna wants you to be 100% all about Him. And so he said, but I see there's something over there that you got. You kind of like that, don't you? And you may be not paying attention to that. You know, no, Krishna, I'm just into you. Krishna's like, no, I think you like that thing over there. No, Krishna, I'm just into you, actually, 100%. For real? For real. And then Krishna's like, okay, that's just, I just want to check that out just to make sure. And then, boom, I do like it. And then you come into this position, it's like Krishna or that thing. So there's no question of escaping like that. Is this answering the question? Yeah, you want to say something to that?
One could argue that actually going into the material world, that's escapism. Because when you're in Krishna consciousness, He brings you face to face with what's actually in the heart, whereas out there, just do so much sense gratification. You sort of just avoid seeing the truth about who you really are.
Yeah, that's a good argument too. Just like some people criticize, you have a question. Some people criticize when I first joined that this is just escapism. I said, I know. My intelligence is working good. Therefore, I'm getting out. You know, what is wrong with that? That's smart. If I'm in prison and you say you're trying to escape, I'm like, yeah, I'm trying to escape. It's intelligent, isn't it? So it's just like you got to put a positive spin on it, just like the brainwashing thing. You know, Hare Krishnas are very famous for being brainwashers. And then when I heard Prabhupada say, yes, we have to wash all the rubbish out of them, I was like, that's so positive, actually. You know, Prabhupada just put a whole new spin on it. And so much so that we were on the train, and one guy said, you people are just brainwashers. And I felt flattered. I said, wow, thank you. It was like receiving a Grammy Award. I'd like to thank God, you know, for this brainwashing award. You know, I worked really hard to get it, you know. Prabhupada made me see it in a whole new light that, yeah, there's so much rubbish in the mind. It has to be washed out. So it's just kind of like the angle you want to look at it. But if we're being a little inauthentic and we are trying to escape, Krishna will test that. There's no question of getting out. That's the nature of having Krishna as our chariot driver. He's going to make us 100% authentic, 100%. You can't be 99% authentic. You got to be 100% if you want to go back to Godhead. Just like someone said that, Prabhupada said, even if you're 50% Krishna conscious, He'll take you back. I'm like, this is cheating language. Try to understand. In order to be 50%, 50% means half of your day you're fully Krishna conscious. Half of the day. So let's say we sleep about, 8 hours, right? So how many hours are left if you sleep 8 hours? 16 hours. Let's say you do 6 hours of service. So you got 10 hours left. So half of that, 5 hours, fully Krishna conscious. Now I'm being nice. So I'm only 5 hours. You have to be fully Krishna conscious. That means no thoughts other than Krishna, no speech other than Krishna. How you will do that without being 100% Krishna conscious? So Prabhupada said 50% is cheating language, you know? It's cheating language to, you know, encourage us that we have to actually become Krishna conscious. Krishna wants 100% authentic in the spiritual world. Not 95%, not 85%, but 100%. So he'll put us in a situation to make us authentic. That's a fact. Yeah, sorry.
Based on what you just said about escaping, I heard Devamrita Swami put it very nicely. He said it's like if you're in a burning building and someone comes and wakes you up and says, hey, the building's on fire, let's get out. And you go outside and everyone outside is like, no, you escaped, what are you doing? Go back inside. No, when you come out, everyone's joyful. Yeah. Wow, you made it, you're saved.
All the same people are joyful, the same people. The same people are joyful. The crazy ones are like, what are you doing, nonsense?
Yeah, an intelligent person will be happy that you've escaped.
Yeah.
But I have a question. We were discussing discussing 529 from Bhagavad Gita, that Gyatva Mam Shanti Michati, a person full consciousness relieves, is freed from the pangs of material miseries. And that's because of their consciousness. It's not that their external circumstances are perfect. You made that comment. It's not that everything is great for them, but their consciousness, they're so tolerant, etc. So for someone that's not on that platform, and we might be striving to tolerate, but you mentioned this about forgiveness, that externally we tolerate or we forgive, but in our heart, you know, we still have difficulty. So it might last for a short time where we're tolerating, okay, I'm tolerating, but then, you know. So how do we deal with that?
Yeah, there's no way in dealing with this, drowning it out. There's a beautiful purport. I wish I had a CC. I need to always bring my Veena, my MacBook, you know. A devotee commented like that in Vrindavan. He said, just like Narada Muni has a Veena, you always carry your MacBook, because wherever I go, I have my MacBook Air with me, you know, because I don't have a good brain like Narada Muni, so I need to open up the computer and see. But it's describing when Lord Chaitanya was distributing love of Godhead. You can read this in chapter 7. I think it starts from like verse 20 or something, the distribution of love of Godhead. So there's this very beautiful description of how, anyone can pull it up, chapter 7 for me, while I'm trying to describe this, how when the flood of love of Godhead drowned all the seeds of material desires and made them impotent. So it's a really beautiful way how Prabhupada describes it, but if you put too much water, you're like trying to grow something, you put too much water in the seed, it kills the seed, it becomes impotent, it can't grow anything. So we have all these seeds of, you know, anya abhilash, all these seeds of desire that are there, other desires. So they have to be drowned out by the process of Krishna consciousness, just making Krishna so much, you know, so much flood of Krishna consciousness by Shravan, Kirtan, Seva, that finished. So in other words, Krishna's instruction is you got to tolerate that. You're not self-realized. Because first he speaks, Dehino smi yata dehe, etc. So Arjuna will say, that's a beautiful philosophy. Love it. You know, I'm not this body and everything. This is Shiva Srinath's comments. But I still see Bhishma is there and Jonah is disturbing him. So then Krishna says, yeah, that you have to tolerate. Matra sparsha su kunti. It's due to sense perception. Now you're going to have to learn how to tolerate. Then what do I do in the meantime? The context of this verse, tolerate, and if you read Prabhupada's purport carefully, and if you need greater clarity, you can check out Sri Baladev Vidyabhushan's commentary. The context of the tolerance is that you have to perform dharma. Because by dharma, you're purified and you'll come to the state of what I spoke about, dehino smin yata dehi. And in the process of doing dharma, the mind is going to pull you away from dharma. So you have to tolerate the actions of the mind and keep yourself fixed on the dharma, which will actually purify you and bring you to the state of realizing that, by which there would be no such disturbance. So for us, the dharma is Yuga Dharma, Harinam, Sankirtan, or Bhagavad Dharma, Shravanam, Kirtanam. So the tolerance is just like, okay, it's there, what to do? Now I gotta focus on the dharma pure. But this, I just wanna, if I can find it, we'll end with this. Oh, I'm not smartphone intelligent here, because, oops, that's not it. It has a touch ID or enter passcode. And, yes. So I'll just find this verse and we'll end with it. This is a really beautiful description. It's Madhya Lila. Yes, in the Adi Lila. No problem. I didn't specify. Chapter 7. Sorry. See. Okay. Yeah, the characteristic sheep in the showing of a Godhead, the answer who is finished. They may, although the numbers were distributed contents, there was no scarcity. The flood of love of Godhead swelled in all directions. Thus young men, old men, women and children were all immersed in inundation. The Krishna consciousness would inundate the entire world and everyone. When the five drowned in love of God in the sea. Yeah, here it is, found it. When the five members of the Panchatattva saw the entire world drowned in love of Godhead and the seed of material enjoyment and the living entities completely destroyed, they all became exceedingly happy. Such a... the purport is really cool. Prabhupada says, in this connection, Srila Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur writes in his Anubhashya, that since the living entities all belong to the marginal potency of the Lord, each and every living entity has a natural tendency to become Krishna conscious, although at the same time the seed of material enjoyment is undoubtedly within him. Undoubtedly. The seed of material enjoyment, now check out this, listen carefully, it's poetic. So because we have really gross consciousness, it's usually hard to pick up poetry in the very beginning. So the seed of material enjoyment, watered by the course of material nature, fructifies to become a tree of material entanglement that endows a living entity with all kinds of material enjoyment. Did y'all catch that? That's beautiful poetry, isn't it? To enjoy such material facilities is to be afflicted with the three material miseries. However, when by nature's law there is a flood, the seeds within the earth become inactive. Similarly, as the inundation of love of Godhead spreads all over the world, or you can say all over the inner world of our being, in the context of the question, the seeds of material enjoyment become impotent. Thus, the more the Krishna conscious movement spreads in our inner world, the more the desire for material enjoyment decreases, the seed of material enjoyment automatically becomes impotent with the increase of the Krishna consciousness movement. So that doesn't just mean increase of the Krishna consciousness movement on the outside, but the increase of the Krishna consciousness movement on the inside. Krishna consciousness movement means to move the living entity from the state of non-accomplishment to the state of accomplishment. That is movement in Krishna consciousness. So I always found a lot of inspiration in that. And I have a lot of issues. Like, I'm messed up. If I were to go, I can also be there with this. You know, it's like, it all began when I joined the Hare Krishna movement. Before that, I was okay, actually. You know, I was pretty good. I had all the exalted qualities of the demigods. But then I started the Krishna conscious movement. You know, I could also go there, you know, because you get realization of how jacked up you really are. After you joined the movement, you didn't realize that before you joined the movement. I thought I was good. Like, someone said, what are your bad qualities? Wow, that's a tough one. But then after being in Krishna consciousness for a while, someone said, what are your bad qualities? I don't want to talk about that. You know, it's too depressing. I'm already a little depressed. I don't want to make it worse. So we all jacked up, but why focus on being jacked up? Why not focus on making Krishna consciousness movement more in our heart? And I know there are different methodologies of approach to this. You'll hear different things from different devotees. Some people find it very important to connect with the emotional issues and so on and identify them. And there's something to that also. I remember reading Brian Rice's book. He had this book. He wasn't a believer of soul and all these things. He's a psychiatrist, and he started doing this regression thing. He tried some hypnosis thing, and he accidentally stumbled upon past life regression. And now he's like a very popular writer, and he writes many books. And he would discover that when people will connect to their past life, they will be having some trauma in this life. And when they connected that trauma was coming from a past life, then they would be relieved of that anxiety in this life. So there is something to that, but the problem with that is that there's unlimited traumas because we've been in the material world for a really long time. So there can be no end to that sort of process. So although there's something to that, our general methodology is just to drown out the seeds. You know, so that these things can't grow up. And that just means a lot of shravan and a lot of kirtan like that. So I'm speaking, so you're hearing that angle. Someone else were to speak, you might hear another angle. All right, we'll end there. It's already 8:30. Thank you very much. Srila Prabhupada ki jai.